Hello, everyone. So I'm going to largely be reading a paper today, a paper that has been sort of composed through a series of fragments that I've been gathering over the past many months. And I sort of struggled a little bit with the title, because I wanted to come up with something more descriptive, and I decided I'll just call it what it is, which is, in a sense, still reading Ananda Kumaraswamy, because I just can't get through all his writings. There's just so much of it. So I thought might as well just call it what it is. So I hope you bear with me as I go through some thoughts on the man. On December 15, 2011, 2 years after the end of the bloody civil war in Sri Lanka, the government of Mahinda Rajapaksa decided to rename a street in Colombo 7, also its most bourgeois district, from Ananda Kumaraswamy Mawatha, Mawatha meaning street in Sinhala, to Nelum Pokuna Mawatha, Nelum Pokuna meaning lotus pond. The reason for the name change was to mark the opening of the Nelum Pokuna Performing Arts Theatre, a Chinese state-funded and built metal structure shaped as a stylized 8-petaled lotus flower. The form of the structure is said to have been inspired by the 12th century lotus ponds of King Parakramabahu I, which he built in the medieval, now ruined, city of Polonnaruwa. Parakramabahu's reign is often mythologized by Sinhala nationalists as a golden age when the Sinhala Buddhist nation is said to have been articulated in state-of-the-art architecture, irrigation systems, and scholarship. Facts such as Parakramabahu's numerous marriages of state with South Indian princesses and his close alliances with Tamil kingdoms is conveniently forgotten. Mahinda Rajapaksa, the reigning president in 2011, had also proclaimed himself as a reincarnate of Parakramabahu, who had not only vanquished the Tamil problem militarily, but had now taken it on to himself to erase symbolic and material traces of Sri Lanka's syncretic, cosmopolitan, and in the context of our discussion today, connected histories. Hybridity was threatening, and Ananda Kumaraswamy was merely one more fatality. Although written from a different time and maybe even a different space and possibly even in a different language, the voice of the Hindi writer Nimal Varma echoes into the post-colonial present. And I quote him, "European colonization cast a shadow right at the center of Indian consciousness, in this case, a Sri Lankan one. Tradition, which was a way of life, was externalized as something belonging to the past. Europe, and now in the case, China, which was an external factor, was internalized as the iron in the soul." The renaming of that pathetic little street in Colombo, however, did not remain uncontested. Artists and intellectuals rallied together to raise awareness of who this man Kumaraswamy was. And on 10th February 2015, the Lotus Pond Street metamorphosized back to its original name when Mahinda Rajapaksa was ousted in a surprise electoral defeat. The metamorphosis of Kumaraswamy into a Chinese-built, civilizationally inspired metallic lotus pond should not surprise us. Maybe this is what samsara means in our time. Continuous cycles of new existences as we go from lotus to stone to iron to asphalt and back again. My point of departure is then a dilemma. Is it possible today to talk about the modern or the region in post-colonial contexts such as Southeast Asia without addressing capitalism first, especially in its industrial form? Anandakumar Swami was born in Colombo, Ceylon, to a Tamil Mudaliar family or father, the legislator and philosopher Sir, he was knighted, Muthu Kumaraswamy of the aristocratic Ponnambalam Kumaraswamy family. And he, of course, had an English mother by the name of Elizabeth Beebe. His father died rather suddenly when Kumaraswamy was just 2 years old. And as a result, he was raised for the most part in England. From 1902 to 1906, he returned to Ceylon as part of his fieldwork for his dissertation on mineralogy and became the first director of the Mineralogical Survey. It was during this fieldwork that his activism against the effects of colonization began to take shape, which led him to establish the Ceylon Reform Society. But it was back in London that Kumaraswamy made his initial presence felt within intellectual circles, a city that we'll return to in a little bit. Suffice to say, at the outset, Kumaraswamy spent his entire intellectual life raging against the machine, making contributions to the fields of art, metaphysics, political economy, and environmentalism, often addressing concerns of imitation and self-determination of the colonized self, intervening into what was the burgeoning ideological spectrum of the early 20th century, and often meditating upon the lotus as a plenipotentiary of Eastern metaphysical awareness, which he often positioned as a critique of Western materialism. In many ways, this erasure in Colombo 7 is something that Kumaraswamy would have reveled in, the only marker in his land of birth, techno-shamanistically transformed into a metallic lotus pond. It is worthwhile mentioning that during his lifetime, Kumaraswamy elided biographical queries, often guiding the inquirer to his writings as guideposts of an evolving philosophical self. This assertion meant that if one sought to understand Kumaraswamy, the man, one had to read his work. And it was in the writings that one finds a sort of locatedness, at once overwhelmingly concerned with all matters connected to the Indian subcontinent, but also operating out of an intellectual milieu that could be regarded as Western for the most part, first in London and thereafter Boston. Both cities not only provide an active backdrop for a closer reading of Kumaraswamy's thoughts, but also enable us to retrospectively gather the critical interventions his ideas made within the so-called universalist canon of Western modernism, especially during the interwar years. This is perhaps maybe too major a task and well beyond the scope of this paper, I understand this. However, I will attempt to analyze two selected writings: Essays in Post-Industrialism, published in 1914, and A History of Indian and Indonesian Art, which appeared in 1927. I hope these two texts will offer some lines of inquiry. However, before we go on to analyze the issues, it is best to start from a personal vantage point. I was trained as a political scientist and later as a historian. And having largely operated within the milieu of the Modern Art Museum, I first encountered Kumaraswamy as a graduate student interested in the fields of South and Southeast Asian studies, in their comparability and apparent unease at speaking with each other. In Kumaraswamy, I found the earliest and probably the most coherent gesture of bridging these two regions, which for the most part only emerged as distinct geopolitical entities decades after his death in 1947 during the Cold War. In Kumaraswamy, I also found a fresh new perspective to such geopolitical constructs of looking at linkages prior to the onset of late modern capitalism and well before Southeast Asia or South Asia had become a concrete reality within state-sponsored cultural projects. This is not to disregard the pioneering work of scholars in the field of area studies, which has been a critical zone for debate and difference. And likewise, to talk about nation states that have invested into this question of area studies, Singapore, where I live, has invested into such an intention more systematically since the 1980s, often seeking to represent and at times even speak for the region and its consciousness through its educational institutions, research institutions, and dare I say, museums. This paper is, however, less concerned with disrupting the existing biography on Kumaraswamy, for which much work has already been undertaken since his passing in 1947. Early efforts were led by his widow, Dona Luisa, and the Malayan scholar Dure Rajasingham, which enabled this, the meticulous biography and collected writings by Roger Lipsy to emerge in 1977. I should state that at the outset that my paper may appear fragmentary, but hopefully not too incoherent. My aim with the Kumaraswamy project, then, is to subtly echo the art historian Pato Mitter when he observes, critical interventions of major thinkers from the periphery in art history are lacking, which by their absence contribute to the erasure of non-metropolitan art practices within the so-called universalist canon. Edited by Kumaraswamy and the architect and social philosopher Arthur J. Penty, Essays in Post-Industrialism, a Symposium of Prophecy Concerning the Future of Society, appeared in 1914, bearing texts by the poet W.Y.B. Yeats, the suffragette Emily Townshend, and artist Eric Gill, amongst others. Many of the contributors were connected by their shared interest in the ideas of William Morris, along with William Blake and Friedrich Nietzsche, two other figures who had also come to grip the world of the feisty art critic Ananda, who dominated London literary circles on all matters pertaining to the past, present, and future of British India. Kumaraswamy coined the term post-industrialism with radical intentions. It was to be a gathering point for anti-industrial critics of the arts and crafts movement, but also as a further means to consolidate his aesthetic critique of the colonial condition through what he called cosmopolitan intermingling. His influence on artists such as Jacob Epstein and Eric Gill, for instance, has received some scholarly attention. The aim of post-industrialism was to present an anti-capitalist alternative to the West and for the West, which would not only compete with the pervasive Eurocentric model of industrial capitalism that was also being enforced as a model worthy of emulation in the colonies, but also systematically critique Marxist models, which were as obsessed with the expansion of machinery as a significant step in the revolutionary program. What post-industrialism offered was a terminal prognosis about, and I quote him, disorder and dishonesty of industrial capitalism, close quote, and the vision of an alternative modernity that was bound to supersede it. Kumaraswamy called this guild socialism. An ideological proposition that sought to guide the municipal, industrial, and social life based on medievalism that would not only replace industrialism as a sort of a romanticized folly, although the group seems to have been aware of such critiques lodged against utopian socialism by Frederick Engels, for example, but provide a foundational basis from which an alternative modernity could be constructed. I quote him, "Imagine a city, a country, or a whole world," declared Kumaraswamy, "not regarding individual life as part of a greater whole, but yet where extremes of wealth and poverty are avoided, where prisons are no longer built by stones of law, where sanitation is beyond criticism, war is perhaps an anachronism, and where the conditions of each form of production and research are controlled by guilds of craftsmen and savants." While many of his comrades looked to medieval England as a plausible source point for such a model, Kumaraswamy offered a parallel, India from the same period. For Kumaraswamy, England and India during the medieval period were equal in stature and hence comparable powers, both in terms of material effects and moral raptures. Guild socialism would radically reorder labor and the conditions of production and lead to the emergence of a renewed spiritual moral being, a superman, half Nietzschean, half Vedic. Almost as if this new being was in fact very old, Kumaraswamy professed. This was long ago realized in India, where the Jivan Mukta, or the freed in this life, is bound by no social rules whatsoever. And the same is true of heroes or avatars. Kumaraswamy's post-industrialism was bound by radical humanism and a revolutionary desire, calling upon the intellect to dream an aesthetic project. I quote him, "The industrial world, however, is not to be overturned by preachers from pulpits. Every one of the forces arrayed for its downfall, on the contrary, assumes an aesthetic form. It is now, as of old, the artists who are secretly shaping life, for they understand that wisdom begins with the flesh, and they consider the body the friend of the soul. Industrialism identifies education with literacy, but the artist avows that he who towers aloft his thought in stone knows as well as the wisest one about the secrets of life, and finds a singer more divine than a professor, a gardener superior to a clerk. Ought we then not to hand over the development of the new world to artists, to poets, painters, sculptors, architects, musicians, and dancers? I would rather ask, ought we not to recognize the artists already in charge and to cooperate with them?" My evocation of this text is guided by the following interests. First, the theoretical potentials are attached to the term post-industrialism. Not only did Kumaraswamy coin the term, but his essay in the volume, if read closely, provides significant insights into his attitude about environmentalism, which has been seriously underestimated even by diehard environmentalists. For instance, he identifies at such an early stage that the growth paradigm, with its concomitant attitudes of both people and nature, had resulted in a social system that was not only about to destroy the environment in the colonies as accident, but deliberately and systematically. Unlike Marx, however, but like Morris, Kumaraswamy laid down his ideas for an alternative. And because he was a rather practical person, at least at this point in his life, provided significant detail. In this alternative, the following attributes apply. Racial diversity of temperament and morality are legitimate and edifying. Asceticism will not be declared as useless, but the movement will also not attempt to declare asceticism onto others as Puritans do. The only unpardonable sin will be to think of oneself as different from other living things. Reason will be recognized as finite and will as eternal. Emotion and perception are co-equals. Art is equal to science. Philosophy is the foundation of both art and science. Body and soul will not be separated but recognized as one. And this is the best one. The wicked will be preferred to those who are moral only from conformity of fear. In effect, the body and the soul will be freed to love and satisfy desires as good citizens and to exercise the divine arts of imagination. What post-industrialism offers, then, is a redefinition of what constitutes work. There is free, unstratified exchange of goods in a decentralized society, and women are emancipated, although there has been some debate about Kumaraswamy's views on gender roles. All these changes made possible by a call for unlearning the modern educational system, which he argues has led to thought, but also circumscribed the ability of modern man to dream. Yet, he asserts, thoughts and dreams are still with us. Dreaming here is not just the possibility of presenting alternatives to industrial capitalism, but is a sort of consciousness where ideas do not exist in a vacuum or become ridden by opportunistic politics. The use of the phrase opportunistic politics possibly alludes to the rise of populism in Europe that had led to the First World War. Dreaming here is then a more restrained act, as a more practical way of art, religion, and philosophy is conceived. Kumaraswamy's leading biographer, Roger Lipsy, remains doubtful, suggesting that his early anti-industrial writings are not relevant to the current ecological debate because they rely too heavily on a romantic solution, the dissolution of industrial society, the appearance of something wholly different, a dream half-baked, half-Blake, half-Morris. Lipsy may well have a point, but to me, they do have the quality of well-put questions. What makes post-industrialism relevant in today's context is the uncanny semblance of the rise in populism, marked by radical shifts in power, where the ability of politics and politicians to change the world is increasingly under scrutiny and doubt. Whilst it may be easy enough to dismiss Kumaraswamy's thoughts as romantic, whose aim is driven towards some pre-modern nostalgic resurrection, perhaps we ought to think about this again, at a moment when industrial capitalism has brought us to the brink of environmental collapse, and the Marxist and neoliberal models lead us senselessly towards continuous growth paradigms driven by the assumption that finite resources can be made to appear limitless. But it is when I read this passage in Penthi's essay, Kumaraswamy's co-author, I am led to think that Kumaraswamy's utopia was not entirely beyond attempt, albeit with a few minor alterations. So I quote him, "If we cannot have godliness, we can at least have cleanliness. Let us have a garden city. Let us produce bread, weighed and measured, baked and eaten in the most efficient manner." Efficient for what? Efficient for everybody. "Let us see to it that everybody learns to read and write and work and keep himself clean, and that marrying and giving in marriage are conducted on the most hygienic lines. And when all is said and done, because some people like it and some who do not like it think there is no harm in it, and perhaps there really is something refined about it, and it does not appear to be possible to do without it. It will creep in, even in the making of cash registers. And some people, notable people, even politicians, think it a quite important feature of life." This vision is followed by a general declaration by Kumaraswamy. "Complex visions or prepotent ideas require a considerable period of time to mature, say 5 to 500 years, according to the nature of the case." Kumaraswamy is, of course, very aware of industrial capitalism. This consciousness also leads him to the pitfalls of projecting an idealist definition. But it is also his materialist view of modernity being evoked in post-industrialism that aids us in revealing the relations behind the changes rather than their external forms. Like the Chinese-built metallic lotus pond in Colombo 7, the Kumaraswamy of 1914 rings of a Kafkaesque being cringing under the welter of industrial, colonial, and bureaucratic malady. Even preempting the triumph of Nehruvian socialism, of a secular and judiciously industrial India, in contrast to the Gandhian vision, which imagined India returning to reform social systems rooted in spirituality, where people lived in small-scale communes, and true moral change would come about not through their ever-increasing industrial productivity, but self-sufficiency. Suffice to say, Kumaraswamy leaned towards the latter vision. And despite the obvious critiques that one can lodge against the young and idealistic art critic in London, his activism would lead to an interesting art historical byproduct, an empowering vision of primitivism that would not only, I suppose, act as a significant critique of modernism, but also attempt to force some cracks into what the literary critic Tabish Kher has described as the Western patented fragments of modernity. I should add at this stage that an empowering concept of primitivism was a strategy developed by many South Asian avant-garde intellectuals of the 1920s. Pato Mitter, for instance, identifies the artist Jamini Roy as a significant case in point. The Tagore circles would be another, and to this coterie, we may well add Kumaraswamy. Kumaraswamy staked his claim in a series of short but very succinct essays published in The New Age, a leading literary magazine in London. In one instance, he takes on Clive Bell's 1914 publication, simply titled Art, where the latter, well, Bell, had taken on a rather disparaging view about primitive art. And so this is what Kumaraswamy says. "It is a source of astonishment to the public that most people who care about art find that of the work that moves them most, the greater part is what scholars call primitive. No other art moves us so profoundly. The reason is that in this sort of art called primitive, we find three common characteristics: absence of representation, absence of technical swagger, sublimely impressive form. Some would say the primitives neglected representation only because they lacked skill. Others say that they practiced what is now called willful distortion. However, what is certain is that primitives never do create illusion nor make an exhibition of smartness. They concentrate their whole energy on the creation of form, and that is why we owe it to them, the finest works of art there are. Of course, the primitives do not belong to any one time or place. There are primitives in Europe, and there were primitives in Europe in the 12th and 13th century. There was William Blake 100 years ago. There were Chinese primitives just after the highly accomplished literati painter Gu Kaixi, and some in modern Europe too. I fear, however, there are no primitives in modern India. In effect, Kumaraswamy illustrates the crux of the matter. The power of Eurocentric discourses was so potent at the turn of the 20th century that the only way to will any other modernity was to begin by acknowledging that modernity had already been removed from the cultural and historical space of countries like India in the course of colonization. It was a provocation. It was not something that he believed. The expression, "there are no primitives in modern India," a consciousness that will become increasingly articulated in the following text we are about to explore, The History of Indian and Indonesian Art. A few years after the publication of Post-Industrialism, in 1917, Kumaraswamy arrived in New York as a political refugee after having declared himself a conscientious objector to serving in the British Armed Forces during the First World War. Although some of his property had been confiscated by the British Crown, Kumaraswamy did manage to cross the Atlantic with much of his art collection intact, especially the Rajput, Pahari, and Kangra paintings, including some key bronzes around which much of his early scholarship had been based. America was an unlikely choice. It was a faraway land, but had institutions that were in the process of being built, with truly encyclopedic ambitions. Not only did America have the resources for such aesthetic grandeur, but also presented Kumaraswamy with a home for his collection and the infrastructure for curatorial work. Kumaraswamy, it seems, was still hesitant, for he had also led the charge in London for the establishment of a museum dedicated to the study of art from the subcontinent in India. Despite his efforts, India was not ready for him. The Boston Museum of Fine Arts was. The museum also had fine legacy. His predecessor was Okakura Kakuzo, who had spent the last decade of his life studying and documenting the Far Eastern collections while shuttling between Boston and the rest of the world in the company of vanguard intellectuals, more often in the pursuit of Asia. Kumaraswamy and Okakura never met, except through their writings. Some correspondence does exist where they express admiration for each other and in the vicinity of things that both men collected and studied for the museum. It is a museum, or at least a sort of curatorial labor that makes it a place, which was very much at the center of Kumaraswamy's life in this new world. He was an archetypal museum professional, one who was measured, institution-oriented, and copious in building up a survey of Indian and Islamic art, but also curious, worldly, and on occasion highly expressive. There is, for instance, a photograph from 1924 in the Princeton archives that I recently discovered, with Kumaraswamy seated on the steps of Borobudur, looking rather gloomy, surrounded by a party of sightseers. The verso reveals a handwritten description, most likely by Kumaraswamy, of the photograph's subject. And this is what it says. AKC, Ananda Kentish Kumaraswamy, led tour of Southeast Asia for Americans. An apt preface to one of his most enduring texts from the period, The History of Indian and Indonesian Art. The years in the lead-up to the publication of the history were spent photographing and assessing the field, which resulted in significant acquisitions and bibliographic publications for the museum. But it was Kumaraswamy's relationship with the dancer Stella Bloch, who accompanied him on his research journeys from 1917 to 1921, that illuminated the curator's thoughts at the time. Bloch was the American artist and dancer who is said to have been the first student in America of Isadora Duncan's six dancers, the Isadorables. Bloch's experiences in India and Indonesia led to her own publication, Dancing and the Drama, East and West, in 1922, a text which lays out a thought-provoking critique of Orientalism through the study of dance forms in Cambodia, Java, and Bali. Merging Nietzsche with Buddhism and Kumaraswamy, the primary observation that Bloch makes is that all craftsmen work within a communal setting and play a ritual function. And not all dancers are craftsmen whose work is only completed with the participation of the audience. In some ways, a true sort of communion. Kumaraswamy's relationship with Bloch would prove transformative as an interfluence between two individuals who were less concerned with the implications of their journey, but in locating and capturing modern everyday life and seeking forms capable of articulating it. In Bloch's papers relating to Kumaraswamy in Princeton, one finds, especially from the period 1921 to 1922, a series of photographs taken by Kumaraswamy of Bloch at his New York and sometimes Boston apartment. At times, Bloch is depicted performing Balinese legong. Some mudras are identifiably Khmer, as she adorns Kain Batik Prada, a cloth used only for Balinese festivals. She stretches sensuously, sometimes staring into the photographer's eye. There's also another photograph where Bloch muses over Kumaraswamy, seeming to sketch him. There has been some discussion on this topic as to what exactly was being attempted here. For instance, in a yet-to-be-published MA thesis, the scholar Kimberly Crosswell posits that although Bloch's contributions were consistently overshadowed by Kumaraswamy, who in a short period of time had established himself within the New York art circles, the strategies remained consistent with numerous avant-garde figures of the time who consciously sought to blur distinctions between everyday life and their art. My own thinking is that Kumaraswamy and Bloch were attempting to access nothing less than the whole of sensate life, the coming together of affections and antipathies, East and West, sensory and corporeal, that which take root in the gaze and the guts. It is as though Bloch suddenly wakes up Kumaraswamy to find that there is an intense swirling territory beyond the mental enclave that threatens to fall outside of its sway. In one of Bloch's sketchbooks from Java in 1919, she scribbles, "The drama is a reincarnation of life and not an interpretation of it. The whole act surrounding the drama is something utterly outside of art, for art is, in its essence, a culmination and interpretation of life and subject to the power of the individual artist. But the drama is life itself speaking through the crafts." Kumaraswamy and Bloch come to be linked in a sort of a purificatory ceremony, cosmic interlace, bhakti, or faith, love, devotion. There is an overwhelming passage in the history of Indian and Indonesian art about the creationist myth of Indian art and culture, where the Aryan and Dravidian worlds are said to have collided, which seems to resonate as well with Bloch and Kumaraswamy's personal devotion to each other. Just, and I quote him, "just in the same way the ascetic and sensual, opposed in primitive thought, and all other pairs of opposites, as theoretically and emotionally reconciled in medieval philosophy and faith. This is, in real sense, was a marriage of East and West, of North and South, consummated, I suppose, at the donors of an image would say, for the good of all sentient beings. a result not of superficial blending of Hellenistic and Indian technique, but of crossing of spiritual tendencies, preoccupations. Indeed, if the dedication for the history or the history of Indian institution art was anything to go by, it is coded. It merely says SP, a sort of telling untold for Stella Bloch. The theoretical manure when text and couple are combined is, if one may like it, akin to the concept of hybridity as a tactic towards empowering diasporic individuals enmeshed within global migration flows that results in being in two places at once. Between performance, writing, movement, collecting, borrowing, perhaps both individuals entered an interstitial passage between fixed identifications and opening up the possibility of a cultural hybridity that entertains difference without an assumed or imposed hierarchy. The key arguments presented in the history of Indian Indonesian art may be laid out as follows. Early archaeological digs indicate the separation of India from Persia in the 3rd century BC, in effect establishing a geographical remit at the edges of what is today Afghanistan, and then stretching outwards until Japan. Kumaraswamy reinforces his two major art historical arguments, the origin of the Buddha image as having been produced simultaneously in Mathura, in northern India, and Gandhara, and arguing that Mughal miniatures and Rajput paintings are different schools of painting. What is also consistent with much of his earlier critiques of industrial capitalism was his evocation of Swadeshi, an economic strategy adopted by Indian nationalists in the early 20th century that sought to boycott European-made products, in the assertion that crafts and the folk are very much part of a grand tradition that had been diminished under colonial rule. A quote from one of Kumaraswamy's most memorable texts, Art and Swadeshi, a pamphlet published in 1912, should suffice. And I quote him, "The 19th century has made of our country a dumping ground for all the vulgar superfluities of European overproduction. In attempting to establish factories for the imitation of European imported goods, we overlook one thing, the relative value of men and things." I can only reluctantly infer that this statement was an effort to forewarn about the impending regressive response that was steadily gaining ground in colonized societies, that lurched from Eurocentric modernization to either reactionary traditionalism or catch-up industrialism. By 1947, the year of Kumaraswamy's passing and the partition of India, the reactionary forces that had emerged in the guise of religious fundamentalism, whilst European-style modernization was declared as the Holy Grail. But the real contribution of the history of Indian and Indonesian art is in Kumaraswamy's extension of Okakura's oft-quoted, misunderstood, heavily debated phrase, "Asia is one." The effect of these considerations, and I quote him here, "The effects of these considerations is to withdraw India from its isolation," he notes. "As a background to the existing art, there is," and now he begins to quote Okakura from Ideals of the East, "there is a common early Asiatic art which has left its utmost ripple marks alike on the shores of Hellenic Greece, Phoenicia, Egypt, India, and China," close quote. All that belongs to this phrase of art is equally the common inheritance of Europe and Asia. He extends it in a different section. And then thereafter, Kumaraswamy goes on to declare, "and its various forms as they occur in India or elsewhere at various periods up to the present day are to be regarded as cognates rather than borrowings." The coupling of the phrases common inheritance and cognate is indicative of a resistance that runs throughout the text against what had steadily been a registration over the 19th century of European hegemony over the modern. But Kumaraswamy also introduces here a methodology, one of seeking connections, cognates, rather than seeking comparative bases for the writing of art history that allows for a non-European present to be considered palpable at the height of empire. There is here a suggestion that histories of other places needed urgent attention if one was to expose the depth of the colonial equation. But cognates can also be allegorical, suggestive of a nearness, a common inheritance, a gift that Kumaraswamy offers to the West. The book was authored in English and published in New York and London, and in Leipzig appeared a simultaneous German translation. The translator was the Berlin Indologist Hermann Goetz, who would go on to become the first director of the National Gallery of Modern Art in New Delhi in 1954. That's a story that needs to be told, I suppose, at some point. Like the cosmic and corporeal play between Stella Bloch and Kumaraswamy, it is my contention that the non-European present being offered in the history of Indian and Indonesian art operates as a significant analytical tool in disrupting and shaping modernism, which at the time had relegated not just India, but what we refer to today as Southeast Asia, as a static, unevolving backdrop beyond time and space. Kumaraswamy's call is then to begin understanding and relocating India and Indonesia within their own set of conventions. He observes this early on. I quote him, "The external influence of Indian thought created a theology and forms of art resembling those of India. The more fundamentally stimulating influence of a method acting inwardly enabled the Japanese genius to realize itself in an attitude of aesthetic appreciation of natural beauty and art, which bears no evident resemblance to anything Indian. In some ways, a new center is suggested and then immediately taken away and undone. Instead, an alternative geography is established that pays close attention to specific art histories, circumstances surrounding their ideologies, incongruities, and fractures in their engagement with a modernity that is conceived as having been presented by India, not just the West. The reason for this intellectual stubbornness, I believe, is that Kumaraswamy understood if he condensed modernity to even the slightest European fetish, not only would he undermine his own thesis and his own activism, but the very act may become deeply counter-modern. He qualifies this, and I quote him again, "To apply the name of Indian colonial," which he also uses in quotes, "to serve national schools after the end of the 8th century is an injustice to the vigor and originality of the local cultures," close quote. In referring to Southeast Asia, he uses the long phrase, "Father India." This is father spelled with an R, so it's F-A-R-T-H-E-R, not father, as in father. "Father India, Ceylon, and Indonesia." A strategic essentialism, I suppose, until further research and groundwork could be laid. Until then, the non-European present that Kumaraswamy puts forward would consciously resist even mentioning, let alone tracking, any trace of modernity either to Europe or European colonization. He states this even more obviously. Quote, "Thus, the history of Father Indian and Indonesian art deserves in the general history of art a higher place that can be denoted by the term colonial. It is true that like much of Chinese and Japanese art, it can only be understood in the light of Indian studies, but it derives its energy from indigenous sources. Collectively, when gathered, the history of Indian and Indonesian art brings to light that complex processes of modernity are and were possible elsewhere too. Grand globalizing narratives were not purely the preserve of the West." My concern with evoking Southeast Asia remains an ongoing matter. On the one hand, to check my own reflexivity on the topic, and on the other hand, remaining aware that regions themselves are made up of diverse temporalities, constructed by different individuals and groups for varying purposes. Even so, within curatorial work, whilst it may be easy enough to reject or even deny the basis for writing a collective Southeast Asian past by asserting the manipulative function it could play, it may still be worthwhile asking what Kumar Swami's thoughts tell us about contemporary questions confronting the field of area studies. In grappling with this dilemma, I evoke the seminal texts, Connected Histories, Notes Towards a Reconfiguration of Early Modern Eurasia by the historian Sanjay Subramaniam, who has led the charge for breaking free from the straitjacket of area studies. Subramaniam begins his text with a warning. Area studies can very rapidly become parochialism, and we often see an insistence taken to the limits of the absurd concerning the unity of Southeast Asia, South Asia, or whatever one happens to study. In the case of South Asia, appeals are made to caste and other multi-millennial civilizational constraints as defining focus. It is as if these conventional geographical units of analysis, fortuitously defined as givens for the intellectually slothful and the result of complex, even murky processes of academic and non-academic engagement, somehow become real and overwhelming. Having helped create Frankenstein's monsters, we are obliged to praise them for their beauty rather than grudgingly acknowledge their limited functional utility. At a moment when Southeast Asian studies seems to be seeking its own right to what Anthony Reed has called an autonomous history, autonomous in relation to the West, India, and China, I presume, a collective reflection may not be such a bad idea. And rest assured, there is a raging debate. Southeast Asianists, or at least those that identify themselves as such, have begun to consider how the field could engage burgeoning trajectories in other zones based on what Subramaniam offers as connected histories in place of comparative ones. Connected histories ebb the primary approach adopted by area studies as a means towards enabling cross-regional dialogues in the tracking of modernization, modernism, and dare I say the word modern. Subramaniam suggests that for such a history to be considered palpable, I quote him, we need to temporarily leave marks at the doorstep of analysis and abandon the developmental perspective, which believes that the only question worth asking is who succeeded and who failed on the long road to modern industrial capitalism from a list of modern nation states. In its place, he offers the possibility of tracking the interface between the local and regional and the supra-regional, even the global. For instance, Subramaniam considers the lateral links that operated in the Bay of Bengal in the 16th and 17th centuries, identifying it as a tightly knit unit of interaction, where one can witness not just the networks of trade and commercial exchange, but also a significant nexus for the crossing of military, courtiers, and religious specialists. Yet largely such connections have fallen through the cracks between defining area studies, he says. And yet it may well be here, at the uncomfortable edges of our categories, that we may find important clues that help us define connectedness. In the history of Indian and Indonesian art, then, Kumar Swami's collapsing of the phrases Father India, Ceylon, and Indonesia to describe Southeast Asia is not accidental. The aim was to establish a geography which, on the one hand, locates India as a reluctant center of an Asiatic art with lines stretching in all directions as far as Japan, Chinese Turkestan, Siam, Ceylon, and into Indonesia, encapsulated by Champa today in South Vietnam, the Malay archipelago well until the island of Bali. But on the other hand, in chapter after chapter, he attempts to open up a series of lateral links that flow backwards and forwards within this geography. Cognates are established, differences are recognized. Even Parakramabahu I, if you recall the king who is considered worth emulating by politicians in contemporary Sri Lanka, finds heroic mention. I quote him, in the 12th century, the greatest of Sinhalese kings, Parakramabahu I, the great, used twice, recovered possession of the whole island, invaded southern India, and maintained relations with the transmaritime kingdoms of Siam and Sumatra. Renewed Tamil invasions again wasted the country. And although in the 13th century, under Parakramabahu III, Polonnaruwa was again occupied in 1361. Ceylon was still in the position to respond to a Siamese request for a Buddhist mission. Close quote. Traces of this Buddhist mission are visible even today at Wat Si Chum, the Sukhothai period temple built between 1357 and 1361. Kumaraswamy continues, "The draftsmanship shows no Siamese peculiarities. On the other hand, it exhibits a very close affinity with that of the Jataka, or the Pali canon, frescoes of the northern temples in Polonnaruwa. Intimate relations had long been maintained between Ceylon and Ramana, and a long inscription of 1361 states that in that year, a very learned Sangharaja, a Buddhist priest of the highest rank, came by invitation from Ceylon to Sukhothai. He was received with great honor, it is said, and that in connection with his arrival, temples were built in the mango gardens west of Sukhothai." Close quote. Like the metallic lotus pond built by the Chinese government in 2011, new existences and cognates continue to be established as we go from lotus to stone to iron to asphalt and back again. When it was published in 1927, one highly respected reviewer of the history of Indian and Indonesian art faulted the text for its overly positivistic tone. I fail to understand this criticism, for it is almost entirely a polemic that seeks out delicate threads that connect. A letter sent from Singapore by Kumaraswamy to Stella Bloch in 1918 is indicative of the connections attempted and desired, and I quote him, "I got one of the rounded Khmer dancer crowns, which will be mailed to you shortly. Masks can be got, but they might not be so useful to you as the Javanese ones, and in any case, they can be sought for at any time." Thank you.